Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our fourth discussion session. It's great to see you. It's still freezing out. Sorry about that. but I wanted to just tell you just a couple things. Tonight, we had some requests to make sure we have the full time in discussion, so we will try to spend full 45 minutes in discussion, period. You know, we'll start with Dr. Khalil's lecture, and then you can go to your discussion groups. If you feel like going to a different discussion group, that's just fine. I wanted to, regarding the book that we read tonight, The Art of Hajj, you know, it was very small, and that some of the images were pretty small. I just want to let you know that we do have, like, much larger books with Islamic art in them, just so you know. We have a whole fine arts library right on this floor on the west side, and it's a beautiful space if you have not visited it. The other announcements I wanted to make is there are a few events coming up, notably next week, beginning on Wednesday evening. The Muslim Studies program is having their annual conference and begins on Wednesday night with a film about Muslim American identities. And then on Thursday and Friday morning, there are panels all day. And so you're welcome to come to any of it. It's all free, right? And you're really welcome and can come in and out. And there are flyers for it on the table out there. I have an extra poster now if anybody wants to take it and put it up somewhere. The other thing, we have something coming up. There are a lot of events coming up at the library, but one is on Thursday, April 3rd. It's a kind of talk on biblical texts in diaspora and digital humanities, which is kind of a fancy title, but it's about our, we have these Samaritan Pentateuchs here at the MSU Library Special Collections, and some scholars that have worked with them extensively and also worked on digitizing them will be speaking, so it's a really nice opportunity to learn about that collection. Okay, so I think that's it, and I'd like to welcome Dr. Khalil up to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. And just to add to that, this conference that we're organizing next week, first of all, you may have noticed the poster. There's the image there looks pretty familiar. It's the last page of your book. And then also, I was going to say that the title is Journeys of Practice. It's a complement to this program, Journeys of Faith. And we have some high-profile scholars who will be visiting us, who will be speaking at the conference. So you don't want to miss that. So that will be next week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So, okay. I begin as usual with Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you. Thank you. This evening, we are discussing the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. And this is the pilgrimage to Greater Mecca. Notice I don't just say Mecca, I say Greater Mecca, because you go to Mecca and nearby cities or towns, or we'll just say Greater Mecca, leave it at that. Because as I'll describe later, you go to Mina, you go to a place called Arafah, or broadly Arafat, and Muzdalifah. And as for Medina, the city of the Prophet's mosque, that's not part of the Hajj, that's not part of the pilgrimage, but anyone who ever goes on a pilgrimage, I mean the vast majority take a stop, they go to Medina. Mecca, of course, is the focal point geographically of the Muslim world. This here is an image of the inside of a drawer in a hotel room in the Muslim world. Uh-oh. This is the inside of a drawer in a hotel room in the Muslim world. You open it and it tells you which way Mecca is. And when you go into other hotel rooms, maybe they'll just mark it, they'll put a sticker somewhere or some kind of indication so you know where Mecca is. And that's because Muslims around the world, five times a day, practicing Muslims, five times a day, maybe three times in some cases, will face Mecca. And the point of this is to unify, or at least one point of this, is to unify Muslims. And what's interesting about this is that, you know, throughout the Muslim world, you have straight lines for prayer. But in Mecca, you have circular lines. And you can't really see it here, But another reason why Mecca is central is because of the Hajj, because of the pilgrimage. When you have millions of people all going to the same part of the world. And this is how, of course, we get the expression Mecca, right? When we say Paris is the Mecca of fashion, right? We mean it's a place where everyone sort of, this is where they go, this is where they congregate for a particular purpose. And so, you know, there are larger congregations around the world. You might hear of, you know, a protest here in this country. You know, in Egypt, for example, there were protests that had millions of people. You have, in other religious traditions, in India, the Ganges, there you go. Ganges, you have larger congregations. But I suppose what makes Mecca unique is just the diversity, the sheer diversity of the congregation. You know, and when you go there, you see people really, I mean, it's you don't see, you know, you don't even see mostly Saudis. It just, you sort of see just a mixture, a very diverse congregation. Now, this is one of the five pillars of Islam. The other four we've discussed before. They are the declaration of faith, prayer, giving to those in need, the alms, fasting in the month of Ramadan, and now the Hajj, the pilgrimage. And if you notice, each of the pillars of Islam, there's a different time frame for each pillar. And the Hajj is interesting because it's a once-in-a-lifetime, at least once-in-a-lifetime event. It's required for those who are able to perform it, physically, financially, at least once in their lifetime. If they can't, they don't. And most Muslims probably don't perform the pilgrimage. Not probably. Most Muslims don't perform the pilgrimage. Nonetheless, many do still. I mean, you have 3 million a year, at least, who go to Mecca. And the Hajj season falls on the 12th and final month of the Islamic calendar, and that is the month of Dhul Hijjah. Now, the Islamic calendar, as I've mentioned before, is a lunar calendar. It goes by the moon. And unlike, say, the Jewish calendar, there's no what's called intercalation. There's not like an additional period that's inserted so that the lunar calendar matches or corresponds to some extent with the solar calendar. It is completely unrelated to the solar calendar. And that's why the pilgrimage this year will be in what? September, I believe, if my math is right. Let's see, Ramadan ends in end of June, so you figure end of July, and then end of August. So around September, October, somewhere around there. And every year it changes. Every year it varies. When my parents performed the pilgrimage, it was hot. It was July. When I performed it, it was December. It was cool. It was nice. So it varies each year. And the Hajj overlaps with one of the two major Islamic holidays. And in this case, it's Eid al-Adha, the festival of sacrifice, which commemorates the sacrifice narrative of Abraham, you know, having to sacrifice or thinking he's going to have to sacrifice his son. And by the way, in the Islamic tradition, which son are we talking about? Ishmael, according to the vast majority of Muslim scholars. Although historically, just to be inclusive here, I should point out that there is a minority of scholars who maintained it was Isaac. But the vast majority maintained it was Ishmael. And that's partly because of what we see in the Hadith corpus. Okay. And the Hajj, the whole period of the Hajj is only about 5-6 days. So it's less than a week. And if you go to Mecca during any other time and you perform certain rituals, that's a pilgrimage, but it's a lesser pilgrimage. It's what's called a umrah, not a hajj. Not a hajj. And so the greater pilgrimage occurs during a specific time of the year. And that's when it gets really crowded. Now, historically, the hajj has facilitated encounters between Muslims from disparate regions of the world. And it has facilitated the transmission of knowledge as well. You have to imagine Hajj in, let's say, the year 1300, you have to imagine a Muslim in Spain, Al-Andalus, taking a long time to get to Mecca, Muslim in China. You know, this is a long journey. And they arrive in Mecca finally,
They encounter other Muslims from other parts of the world. They learn new things. And even today, you have people who don't have the means to perform a pilgrimage by plane or by train or by boat. And so this is very interesting. In some parts of West Africa, they'll move to a nearby city to the east, work there until they have enough money to keep going. They move to another city in the east, and it eventually takes them maybe 7 years to get to Mecca. Then they work their way back. Very interesting. Of course, in modern times, transportation is very quick. So most people can get there quickly. Some people say, well, you know, the transmission of disease is also an issue, but that's really only a modern issue to some extent, because in the old days, it would take you a while to get back. So nowadays, everyone just kind of goes and flies out. Historically, Muslim chroniclers portray the Hajj as an arduous yet spiritually fulfilling journey. What is the purpose of a pilgrimage? Because we see it in other traditions. What is the purpose of a pilgrimage? That's not a rhetorical question. Say it again. To cleanse yourself. Okay, to purify yourself. Okay. What else? Affirm your faith. So notice the two responses here have to do with the self, right? You are going to another location. You are going to a holy site. But it's ultimately about you, right? It's about finding yourself, okay? And so many people will describe the spiritually fulfilling moments that they had during the pilgrimage. And I'll give you an example of that in a moment. So just looking at it in history, there are many fascinating accounts of the Hajj. And let me just give you three here that are of interest. First, the Prophet. The Prophet only performs one true Hajj. And it's during the last full year of his life. And it's during this Hajj that he gives his very famous final sermon. So the Hajj, so that obviously is the most well-known Hajj of all time. And from that we get the precedence for later Muslims, what they should do during the pilgrimage. Another interesting one, very different, is the pilgrimage of Mansa Kankan Musa, the ruler of Mali of the 14th century. He was an extremely wealthy figure who leaves Mali with, as described in the book, slaves carrying gold, right? And along the way, he stops in Cairo, causes inflation single-handedly for an entire decade, according to some accounts. Some say 12 years. And then he proceeds to Mecca, causes inflation there, according to other accounts. And so here was a legendary figure. And by the way, just a fun fact, his brother, the reason he becomes king is because his brother leaves, goes off to the west in the ocean. And we never hear from him again. And some archaeologists have discovered Mandinga masks in, I believe it's Central America. Or maybe it was South America. I forget now. So there's these theories. They're not, you know, these aren't things that historians can confirm, but there are theories that maybe he made it, that Mansa Musa's brother made it to the Americas. And actually, it's easier to get to the Americas from west coast of Africa than it is from Europe because of the currents. So you never know. Speaking of African Americans now, the next figure I list is Malcolm X, Al-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, as he's also known. Notice he's given the title Al-Hajj because he performed the Hajj. This is an honorary title that people receive when they perform the Hajj. In fact, when I was there, you know, while we're still performing the Hajj, you see people calling people by this honorary title, Hajji, 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 or if it's a woman, Hajja, Hajja. And even in Egypt today, it's customary to call an elder a Hajj or a Hajja. Actually, they would say Hajja. They don't pronounce the J. And so even though maybe they didn't perform the pilgrimage, but just because they're an elder, so it's assumed that they are a pilgrim. Malcolm X, of course, his pilgrimage is interesting. He travels to Africa. He travels to sub-Saharan Africa, goes to Egypt, goes to perform the pilgrimage. And it's during the pilgrimage that he describes his change of heart when it comes to interracial relations. He describes how he eats from the same plate and shares food with people who are blonde hair, blue-eyed, right? And he says that I've changed my perception of white people. And he says that we ultimately can we can get to the point where blacks and whites and others can get along. And when he comes back from this pilgrimage, he sounds very different from how he sounded before. He says things like, you know, now I have friends who are atheists and Christians and Jews and others. He was still critical of the government, of course, still made some remarks that were deemed controversial. But nonetheless, he presents this Hajj as a transformative event for him, seeing people from different parts of the world getting along. And I was, you know, when I was there in 2007, I was actually, I thought maybe, you know, because you hear about people, you hear people say this is romanticized, and to some extent it is. But I found, I was struck also by the harmony of the Hajj. I mean, for the most part, you have people sort of getting along, Sunnis and Shiites. I was there the year that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was there. Never saw him, but he was there. And it was interesting because you'd go around the Kaaba and you hear people out loud saying Shiite prayers. And, you know, in Saudi Arabia, and you know, no problem, at least when I was there. In fact, I only saw two arguments, nothing physical, and just two verbal arguments. One was between two individuals from the same country, and it was because one had tripped the other accidentally, and they began to yell. And the other was when my group, my Hajj group, wanted to get inside the tent area, and the guards wouldn't let us, and so our leaders wanted to show us that they were defending us, and so they gave them a good yell. But that was the extent of it. I what I saw for the most part was people genuinely getting along. And I had some very beautiful conversations with people from India, people from Malaysia, Indonesia. Really quite interesting. All right. Now let's talk about the Hajj rites. The first thing one does when they perform the Hajj is they enter into a state of ihram. Can you all say ihram? Yeah, ihram. Yeah. Ihram is a state where you don't do things that you typically do. So for instance, you don't cut your nails, you don't cut your hair, you don't you try to hold yourself back, you know, you don't you just try to be unusually patient, put it that way. Now, don't worry, this is a short period of time. It's, you know, a few days. So you know, people usually will cut their hair before the period begins. So, yeah, or you trim their nails. When you enter this state, you see people sort of, you know, you get this feeling of, you know, there's a sense that they're sort of subdued during this period. They're thinking about God now. They want to make sure that this pilgrimage counts, because for many, it's their once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So even if somebody gives them a hard time, maybe they'll just sort of say, okay. Because they don't want to get out of this state of ihram. And the first thing you do is you go to Mecca and you perform the tawaf. Can you all say tawaf? Yeah, tawaf is circling around the Kaaba. So you enter and you go around the Kaaba. And for those who are bold, they will do this on the main level. Everybody else, you know, it gets tight, people push, but for many, they may prefer that actually, because you kind of lose yourself in the motion as it goes around and around and around seven times. And it is said that this ritual began during the time of Abraham and Ishmael, when they established I don't want to say Kaaba, because that's what Jonathan Brown, that's the term he uses. But Kaaba really means cube, and many would say that the original structure built by Abraham and Ishmael was not necessarily cube-like. So I don't know if Kaaba is the best word, but definitely a house of worship. So the house of worship that they established, there was a tawaf. There were people going around, presumably Abraham and Ishmael, maybe others, going around the Kaaba. That is the belief. Now, the next thing that one does is the sa'i. This is a hard one. Can you all say sa'i?
Sa'i.
There you go. You got it. Sa'i. The sa'i is walking or running between the hills of Safa and Marwa.
Now, it's only in recent decades that these hills are enclosed. It used to be that you would walk or run outside. Now it's enclosed.
And this is symbolic of Hagar, or Hajar in Arabic, her frantic search for water as she's left alone with Ishmael in the desert. And she frantically runs 7 times until finally, miraculously, she is given water through a well called Zemzem. Can you all say Zemzem? That's easy.
Zemzem.
Zemzem. And this well is what allows Mecca to survive, essentially. And to this day, you know, pilgrims make it a point to drink the Zemzem water while they're there. And what's interesting is, you know, many pilgrims will come back from the pilgrimage with their bottles of Zemzem. And what I always found interesting was when people would bring it back and I would taste it, I didn't really appreciate the taste. But when I was there, I loved it. It nourishes you. Imagine you're in the desert and there's something about it. It's kind of like thick water. There's something about it that nourishes when you are in that desert climate. And so notice, by the way, that so far we've mentioned Abraham, Hagar, and Ishmael. I mean, they're really the central figures of this pilgrimage. Okay. Next we have camping in Mina. So on the outskirts of Mecca, there's a, I don't know what the right word is, we'll just say a place called Mina. I guess we could say town. And this, during the pilgrimage season, becomes a tent city. And this is not even the most impressive photo. There are photos where you just see a sea of white tents. And this is where pilgrims sleep at night. And what's interesting about this is, you know, from the outside, all the tents look the same. And the inside, of course, they might vary, and, you know, some might have cushioned, you know, mats, others might not. But for the most part, you really can't sense the difference between the various tents. And this also applies to the way people are dressed. For the most part, the line between rich and poor is blurry. You might get a sense, okay, this person maybe is better off than that other person, but it's blurry. The line is blurry. People are dressed in simple garments. And there's something about this that reminds people of death. Because when you enter into the state of ihram, you wash yourself, and then you wrap yourself in simple white garments. Well, this is similar to what one does to a corpse in Islamic tradition. You wash the body, and you wrap it in simple white garments. And so there is a reminder of death throughout this whole pilgrimage. You have to imagine you're leaving people behind. You're leaving your belongings behind, especially when you go to Mina, the tent city of Mina. You're only allowed to bring maybe a bag or two, something, you know, nothing, not too much. And you're living a simple life in these garments that look like the kind of garments you would be buried in. So there's a stark reminder of death throughout this process. Okay, so this is where pilgrims sleep at night for most of the nights. Now, the most important part of the pilgrimage occurs in the 9th day of this month, Dhul-Hijjah, the 12th month. And it's when the pilgrims spend the day at a place called Arafah, or broadly, Arafat. And here is an image of this site. And you'll notice there is a pillar in the background there, at the top of the hill. This is what's called the Mountain of Mercy. And it's there that the Prophet reportedly gave his final sermon, his famous final sermon, which we discussed a couple of sessions ago. And this is the most important ritual or rite of the Hajj. There's a hadith that says that this is the Hajj. And if you miss it, you miss the Hajj. So you have to catch it. Now, there are situations where it's overcrowded and people try to get there, and you know, they can't. Some would say, okay, that's okay. Your intention was there. So yeah, that would count. But the point is that it's a critical part of the Hajj. Everyone comes together. They reflect. And it's not as if there's anything, you know, there are no fireworks shows. It's just people there reflecting. That's all it is. And you will see people crying. You know, this is when you see people having intense spiritual moments, is on this day. At night, everyone proceeds to a nearby place called Muzdalifa. And I think this image really captures Muzdalifa. It's dark, but you see light, and you see everyone just sort of laying, relaxing, recovering from their day, Arafah. And, you know, many people will sleep during this period. And then they will proceed back to Mina. Ooh, to Mina. Now, the next day is the holiday, the major Islamic holiday that we discussed, the festival of sacrifice. And this is when pilgrims now, either directly or indirectly, will sacrifice an animal of some sort, a lamb, or a sheep, excuse me, a cow even. And this, and then the meat is distributed to the poor, usually, to those in need. And what's important to keep in mind here is that this, you know, for most of Islamic history, eating meat was a special occasion. It wasn't something you do every day, as we see here, right? It was a special occasion. It was, you know, okay, this is a special, it's a sacrifice. It's a special occasion. And there are all kinds of rules for the actual slaughtering process. You're supposed to turn the animal's face away from the blade. The blade has to be sharp. And there are all these rules that are intended to minimize the suffering. In any case, and this involves also removing, sort of cutting the blood out, having the blood run out so that they lose consciousness before they feel much of the pain. The intention is to minimize the pain. And this is in Arabic, it's called, I don't mean to be so graphic, I know. This isn't the loveliest topic to discuss, but anyway, in Arabic this is called udhiya, and in Persian or Urdu, qurbani. These are common terms that you'll hear. Now, after this, and this of course commemorates the Abraham narrative. All right. In case you're wondering, the other major holiday is the one that comes the day after Ramadan, after the month of fasting. That is the festival of breaking the fast. Okay, one more ritual to discuss, and that is the symbolic stoning of the devil. This actually does not appear in the Quran, unlike most of the other rituals that I've discussed, but it appears in the Hadith corpus. And this is symbolic of Abraham stoning the devil, throwing stones at the devil when the devil tempts him not to sacrifice his son. And it's said that, there are different accounts, but one, the most famous account is he is tempted in three different places. And where he throws stones, that is where the pillars are built. And pilgrims then, in following this, will throw stones at the symbolic representation of the devil. And for many, it's a kind of physical release during the pilgrimage. And it's, again, symbolic of one's rebellion against Satan. And it's not as if you have to, you know, get some big stone and chuck it. Again, it's symbolic, right? So the prophet said, just grab some pebbles. Don't grab anything too large. And they actually say, it's actually considered a problem if you grab something large. Just grab something small, and it's a symbolic, you know, you could say, refutation of the devil. Okay. All right. Let me just end by showing you a few images. The first is an image of the Kaaba without the kiswa, without the black cloth that adorns it. We often assume that it always had this black cloth adorning it. In fact, as the book indicates even, This was a development that began during the Abbasid era. The Abbasid era begins in 750 and runs until 1258. That is when the Kaaba, they would use only a black kiswa. Before that, they would use different colors. So just an interesting fact. Here's a look at the inside of the Kaaba. The inside of the Kaaba is fairly plain. And, you know, I remember my great-grandmother. She was chosen. She was actually permitted to go inside the Kaaba. And we asked her, what did you see? She said, I can't tell anyone. Well, now we can get it on YouTube. We can see it now. And really, it's empty. It's an empty room. I want to stress here the fact that this building is not, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, this is some kind of a god or a deity for Muslims. This is just a building that represents the house of God. And there's a famous hadith in which the prophet says that essentially the blood of, you know, the blood of a human being is worth more than this building, this entire building, the Kaaba, right? So, and by the way, I mean, the Kaaba, it's been rebuilt, you know, since the time of the prophet, three times at least. So, you know, we should be careful here not to, you know, it's a special building, but it's not a deity. It's not some kind of, right? It's just the symbol, it's just the center. Now, you'll notice also that built into one of the corners is what's called the black stone. The black stone. The black stone, I don't recall even an implicit reference to it in the Quran. But in the Hadith corpus, we get all kinds of reports about the black stone. Here it is up close. And there are all kinds of reports about its origins. One famous account is that it descended from heaven pure white, and as people with their sins kissed it, it became dark. Ultimately, though, there's no consensus as to the origin and purpose of this stone. In fact, there's a famous report of the second caliph, Omar, going up to it and kissing it. And he says, I really don't know what your significance is, but I saw the prophet kissing you, so I'm just going to follow the prophet. So there's no consensus as to what its significance is. Nonetheless, people imitating the prophet will go to kiss it, and we can say that it's the oldest part of the Kaaba. It is the oldest part of the Kaaba. Okay. And one final image. For those pilgrims who are done visiting the Kaaba, or maybe before they visit the Kaaba, they'll go to Medina.
This is an image of the Prophet's Mosque in Medina. And what's interesting about this mosque, only one level, and when you enter it, you go all the way to the end, and guess what? The Prophet's buried to the side. He's not buried in the middle. He's not the focal point of the mosque. He's off to the side. He's toward the front, but he's to the side. And this, again, stresses the fact, or highlights the fact, that although he is human, he is not divine. And so believers face the Qibla, the direction of prayer, and not, they don't face the Prophet. And I'll just add here also that while people perform the pilgrimage, they will typically try to visit other sites of interest. For instance, near Mecca, there is the cave in which the Prophet is said to have received his first revelation. And I try to go up there, and it was crowded. It was during the Hajj season, so it was crowded. It's hard to get up there. And finally, I pushed my way, and I got to the top, and I could see the cave. I was just made from here to there. But it was so crowded, I had to give up. And I felt so, I mean, can you imagine? I came all this way, and I had to give up. At one point, I was being pushed by some people behind me, and then people here were getting mad at me, and I said, well, they're pushing. So it was kind of, it was hard. And then also near the Kaaba, they have the Library of Mecca, right outside of the sanctuary. And they say this is where the Prophet was born.
So you see all kinds of people trying to touch it, and because they assume there are blessings. And the Saudi government, they're pretty strict about this. They don't want people making too much of this. Because again, the prophet is just the prophet from the way they see it. So I asked, can I go inside? And they said, no. I said, well, what if I told you I'm a professor of Islamic studies in America? Suddenly, they said, come back in a couple hours. And I came back, and they let me in. And I had a special VIP tour of the library. It was really funny. But it was pretty. It was also pretty neat. And it was interesting because I got to see old, rare images of the region, of Mecca. And it's interesting to see, you know, we often assume that people in Saudi Arabia dress a certain way. Well, in the 1920s, they dressed very differently. More colorful clothing. I mean, there's this assumption that it's all black. And I mean, for the women, for example. No, actually, in the 1920s, it was very different, actually. So anyway, just an interesting side note there. Okay, I think... Let's save the questions for the end. So let's go ahead and split into groups. All right, let's do it. I'll keep these images up here in case you'd like to look at them.
Arrogance and forgiveness.
Yes. Yeah. The idea that one has to, recognizing that they are going to forget, they have to exert effort to overcome that.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So one of the points I was trying to make, and I realized after I finished speaking that I never made the point, is that the lines, you know, that face Mecca are straight lines. I said this in one of the groups. They're straight lines, but when they get to Mecca, they're a circle. You get a circle. So you see here, for example, everyone around the Kaaba, and it's pretty amazing to see everybody prostrate at the same time. You know, it's symbolic of the oneness of humanity and the oneness of God. You know, one humanity bowing down, prostrating before the one God. There was a question about the Safa and the Marwa, the hills. That Muslims will walk or run between. Here was the image that I showed you of people walking or running between the two hills. And somebody was asking, so where is this? Like, you know, I said it's indoors. So here is the Kaaba. And you see this straight line right here, straight line of lights? That's the path of the Safa and the Marwa. It's actually attached to the building. It's part of the building. Straight line of lights right here. So,
short.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not that long. Although it is kind of tiring, actually. At least by number six or seven. I don't know. It's kind of tiring. But especially if you're running it. But there you go. Okay. Let's open the floor for questions. Yes. Ooh. Yes. Yeah, I mean, you know, some women will actually wear different colors, but yeah, most will wear white still. Yeah.
And you're supposed to keep that because when you die, they're supposed to wrap you with that.
I mean, you're not supposed to, but some do it.
But it's recommended, right?
Is it recommended? I don't even know if it's recommended, to be honest with you. I mean, maybe culturally in some contexts, but I don't know of any hadith that would recommend that. But many people do it anyway. Many people do that anyway. Yeah. Right. You know, that's where I think we're dealing with different customs, right? You know, it's more of a cultural thing. So yeah, and so for some people, they'll do exactly that. They won't touch it, and they'll be buried in it, and that's that. Others will get rid of it, and that's it. You know, there's nothing in the hadith corpus that I can recall that explicitly addresses that. And I could be wrong, but I mean, there are many hadiths, of course, but I don't recall anything in the hadith corpus that addresses that. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, the idea that all your sins are forgiven, that is explicitly indicated in the hadith corpus, not in the Quran, but in the hadith corpus. And it says, yeah, all your sins are forgiven. And, you know, so, you know, some people take advantage of that. You know, some people will say, yeah, I'll do this, this, and that, and then I'll just perform the hajj and it'll be okay, right? But that's seen as not being in the spirit of the Hajj, right? And the whole idea of having your sins forgiven, the whole point is to say that I've transformed, I've become a better person. There's a famous hadith about and there are different versions of this hadith, so I'll just give you, I'll make it generic. Somebody who is a sinner, and then at the end of one version it's her, one version it's his life, he or she, in most versions it's a woman, she feeds a starving animal. And then she dies, and then she goes to paradise because she ended her life on a good note. She had transformed herself at the end of her life. The whole point, the whole idea of your sins being forgiven is that you have transformed yourself, right? It's not just some kind of cheap trick. Oh, I stole, I lied, but you know, I'm planning to do a Hajj to cross that out, and then maybe I'll come back and maybe do it again, and then just do another Hajj. You know, that would be seen as contrary to the spirit of the Hajj. At least that's how most would see it.
Let me share something from Pakistan regarding this Hajj, you know. It's a saying in Pakistan that the cat has gone to Hajj after eating 100 mice.
And, you know, in many cases, you know, it's because of the quota system, many people who go to Hajj are people who are older and who maybe have had a long life, they've done a lot of things, and, you know, they've eaten 100 mice. Yes?
So while you're doing this, just a silly little question. Where do you eat? Are there...
Yeah. You know,
lunch
as
lunch carts, or do you prepare your own food?
There's everything. In fact, I was just remarking, I made a remark that, you know, you can get a KFC. You can see a KFC just outside of the Kaaba.
So there are restaurants you go to?
And, you know, I personally was kind of, I was opposed to that. I actually made it a point not to eat at the KFCs there. But my buddies, they were loving it. They had, you know, finger looking good. They were they were enjoying themselves. But, there's anything you want there. Most people lose weight during the Hajj, though. I know I lost.
That's part of it.
I lost something like 30 pounds in 19 days.
So some people do try to fast while they do this?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't fast. I just, you know, ate light. Part of it was because, you know, when you were in the tent city of Mina, part of it is you don't really want to go to the bathroom. You don't want to use the bathroom.
There are porta potties around?
Yeah. But part of it also is just you want to live, you don't want to be distracted. You just want to be simple and you do a lot of walking. I lost something like 30, 35 pounds in 19 days.
Wow.
Yeah, beats a Jenny Craig, right? So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, I was curious about the Umrah.
Yeah.
I may be mispronouncing it, but...
The lesser pilgrimage at any other time of the year, yeah.
Yeah, is that, do you have the same kind of tradition or the same rituals? In order?
It's slightly different. Well, not slightly, it's different. For example, there's no, you know, you don't go to like Arafah and you don't, I mean, you go to certain places, but most of it is in the Kaaba itself. It involves rituals at the Kaaba. Usually you'll go outside, you'll get into ihram, in a state of ihram, you'll come back, you'll do certain rituals in the Kaaba itself. And that's pretty much it. It's pretty relatively simple compared to the Hajj. So yeah, you're not throwing stones and all that. It's mostly within the Kaaba itself, that area.
And it's like organized in the same way?
It could be organized, it could be informal. So when I did the Hajj, we actually did two Umrahs in addition to the Hajj while we were there. I was there for 19 days. So did the Hajj and then two or three of us just did two Umrahs, you know, on our own. And it was fairly simple. So, yeah. You know, the Quran, if you want to look at what the Quran actually says, the Quran says, it commands Muslims to do the Hajj and Umrah. It actually includes the Umrah. So when people do the Hajj, they'll usually sneak in an Umrah while they're there. Yeah. Other questions?
Thanks. So I was wondering, you know, thinking about how the Hajj has become an event that the Saudi government has basically has to accommodate like 3 million people.
And right.
And I was kind of interested that you said that now there's KFC options there. So do you think, you know, maybe there's a commercialization of it or how? things like that have impacted, you know, the ultimate spiritual purpose of the pilgrimage.
Yeah, and I was mentioned to another group. Now they have what is maybe the second tallest building in the world, the clock tower of Mecca, right next to the Kaaba. And for some people, this is a good development. They see it as, you know, people are going to live in Mecca, and they're, you know, other people see it as materialism. Personally, I find it repulsive, to be personally. I mean, when you're going around the Kaaba and you see this huge thing, you know, that's not, you're no longer focused on the Kaaba. You're focused on this huge thing. And to see, I mean, you know, Paris Hilton just tweeted that he opened up a new purse shop near the Kaaba. I mean, she's never going to go there because, you know, it's Mecca. But, I mean, it's become commercial. You have everything there, all these companies there making money. And you wonder if Mecca is maybe losing some of the original, I don't know, what's the word? Spirits. Yeah, some of that is lost. And this, of course, is a problem throughout the world. I was mentioning that, you know, when you go to the pyramids in Egypt, even, you see a Pizza Hut right there. Pizza Hut, Baskin Robbins. You know, it's all, you can see it right there from the Sphinx. So this is a problem throughout the world, I would say. I would call it a problem. I mean, you know, no problem. I mean, I'll eat Pizza Hut, okay, but, you know, when you're in these special places, I think it should be, yeah.
But what about, like, the things that the government has to do to accommodate, like, the large crowds, like creating the enclosure for people to,
right,
you know, travel between the two mountains,
right,
or, like, you know, making this tent city, does having to plan and organize so much detract from, like, an organic spiritual nature that
maybe? Maybe. I mean, I know that from my own experience, you know, my group, we thought they had a pretty spiritually fulfilling experience. They, you know, it was, but that was 2007. I don't know how it is now. And, I don't know. My father actually just performed the Hajj this past year I think this is his third time now. And, you know, I asked him, you know, were you distracted by these things? He's like, yeah, you notice them. You notice them. But he seemed to have had a good experience. So I don't know. It's, you know, maybe you just get used to it, right? You get desensitized. So, I mean, we stayed at a Hilton hotel right next to the Kaaba. And I wasn't sure what to make of that, you know. And it's a 5-star hotel. You know, I felt kind of guilty to some extent. Because this was after, you know, imagine you're in the 10th city of Mina. You're living a very simple life, and then all of a sudden you're in the 5-star Hilton hotel, and you're at a buffet now, and you have a nice hotel room. I mean, part of me felt guilty, actually. I thought, wait, is this really the spirit of the Hajj? I don't, you know. But it was amazing seeing everybody who had just been, you know, really dirty, and, you know, now they're in the hotel, they're all dressed nicely, and, you know, it was interesting seeing the contrast. Yeah.
Pristine spiritual experience, you know. And on the other hand, I think that, don't people write a critique of this development?
Yeah, there's a lot of critique, yeah. I mean, you know, one of the critiques is that they are removing historical sites. So, for example, there was a building next to the Kaaba called the House of Khadija, the first wife of the Prophet, Khadija. Yeah. And they removed that. And I remember when I went into the library, remember I told you I got into the library with my faculty card? Okay, so when I got into the library, I spoke with the librarian and I asked him, you know, how could this be okay? And his response was, well, I mean, let's be realistic here. This probably wasn't Khadija's house. That was his response. So, I mean, maybe he's right. I don't know, but still it's a historic, you know, it's at least several centuries old. So, I don't know, it's... as somebody who values historical sites, I find it, you know, troubling, personally. The flip side of that, because I have relatives who are for the flip side of that, and they would say, but this is encouraging people to go to Mecca, and it's, you know, it's allowing them to be comfortable. That's their argument. So, you know, keep in mind in Sufism, we'll learn about Sufism next time. In Sufism, there are many who are ascetic; they live a simple life. This in Arabic is called zuhd. But there's also some Sufis who, they're a minority, but they actually say it's good to live a material life, so that materialistic life, because you can be comfortable, and then you can focus on God. So that's another perspective. So that perspective seems to have, yeah. Not necessarily from the Sufi angle, but yeah. Yeah.
So if you meet another, I'll use this. If you meet another Muslim here in Michigan, to what extent would you expect that they had already been on a Hajj? Is this something common to most?
If you're, let's say you go to the Islamic Center.
Yeah.
And you walk into the Islamic Center and you ask how many people, and let's say it's a Friday prayer, how many here have gone on the pilgrimage? Gosh, I would hazard that half. I don't know, Tahsin, what do you think?
Just 1%.
1%?
Yeah.
Out of Jum'ah congregation?
Yeah.
Really? Oh,
so somewhere
that's a very different estimate from
between 1 and 50?
I mean, if it's a congregation of 500 people, I would don't know. I don't know. All maybe right. You could be right, but yeah, I mean, well, I guess.
I would disagree with that.
Uh-huh.
1% is a little low. I mean, 50% perhaps is
maybe it's too high.
High.
So let's say 25. We'll call it 25. We'll call it even.
Maybe I was picturing the entire Muslim
population. Oh, I see. No, but let's say you go to the mosque here in East Lansing on a Friday prayer. What would you guess? What percent have done the Hajj? 25, maybe?
Yeah, probably lower than 20. That.
Okay.
I was just curious.
Yeah, yeah.
To be exact.
Yeah, yeah. But I will say this. When you do encounter someone and you ask them, how was your Hajj experience? What I have found is that often they see it as a very special experience. You know, when we had, there was the Eid prayer a year ago, and I met a group of African-American Muslims who had performed the Hajj, and I asked them, what was your experience like? And they just stopped everything, and they said, oh, let me tell you about this Hajj. It moved them. It was a moving experience for them. And when I speak to Egyptians who've gone on, I mean, most people who have gone on the Hajj, you can tell. They have stories. They have interesting experiences that they went through. I had some interesting experiences in my Hajj. Yeah, but that has nothing to do with your question. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. That's an interesting part of it, too.
Sure, sure. Other questions? We have a question here. Oh, yeah, Tahsin.
I'd just like to add a comment to the earlier question of commercialization.
Yeah.
Yes, while that is happening, for the have-nots, there are other options. Traditionally, during the Hajj, you'll find the local population bringing in food for the people who are basically, who can't afford,
yeah.
or even if you can afford, they're just distributing food, the locals from the city there.
Yeah.
To the extent that there's one member in our community, he's a big donor at the Islamic Center, so he's a very wealthy person. And when he sought help from somebody just to get up, the person not only helped him, a local from Saudi Arabia, but he even slipped some money into his pocket. So that spirit of charity and giving is still there, even though there's commercialization on one side.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, historically, it was understood that, yeah, you can still trade and buy things. And, you know, it's not like when during the pilgrimage you have to stop doing what you normally do. But I guess the concern these days is, yeah, you know, the extent, you know, these huge towers and, all these Pizza Huts and KFCs and all that. Yeah, there was a question over somewhere here, maybe? No? It's getting late. Okay, all right. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. See everybody in 2 weeks, and we have the Rumi anthology. And if anybody did not receive the email from me that says which poems to focus on, please see me, and I'll make sure you get that one way or another. Okay, good night.